It is with excitement that I get to share with you that the Leukemia Foundation has developed a new resource. This resource is called the Online Support Service, where it provides a wealth of services to assist a person living with blood cancer throughout their patient journey. So whether you're a patient who has just been diagnosed, in treatment or in survivorship, this service provides access to targeted learning modules, a suite of amazing services and online programs. And you also have the ability to chat with an experienced blood cancer support coordinator at just one click. It gives people a personalized and intuitive way to learn about important topics, including what to expect beyond treatment. This service is simple to use and is filled with content curated by the Leukemia Foundation for people with any type of blood cancer. It notably features a digital energy coach to help patients manage fatigue. So jump onto our website and look up our new and exciting product called the Online Blood Cancer Support Service.
You get to a point in life where you think you're in control of everything, and all of a sudden it gets taken out from underneath you.
I guess I kind of felt ripped off.
It's just living in the moment and just being adaptable to situations.
Give people voices to talk about, you know what, that phase is often the hardest, and be prepared for it because it's not what you think it will be.
Talking Blood Cancer, a podcast for those facing blood cancer by the Leukemia Foundation.
Find the best way forward using their own purpose that they have in their life and using their passions.
I've lost fear and doubt. Like, I no longer doubt myself in situations, and nothing scares me.
That gives you another goal to work towards and a reason to live.
Hi, I'm Kate Arkadiv, and I am the host of Talking Blood Cancer. This podcast shares the stories of the people we have connected with who have faced a blood cancer, so that you, our listeners, can gain insight, find purpose, and take inspiration. Before we get into today's episode, the Leukemia Foundation acknowledges the traditional owners of the land on which we share these stories. We recognise their continuing connection to land, sea, and community as the first storytellers of this country. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. This story may contain content that some listeners may find difficult and challenging. We encourage anyone listening to take care of their own mental health and well-being. The purpose of this podcast is to share real-life stories of people living with a blood cancer, and any discussion of medical treatments is not an endorsement. We encourage you to seek advice from your treatment team if you have any questions regarding your diagnosis, side effects, or treatment. If you would like to talk to someone, or even if you would like more information on our services or today's episode, please feel free to contact 1-800-620-420, and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. So, let's get into today's episode. In today's episode, I interview Michael, who is from Sydney. In 2019, Michael at the time was 33 years old. One morning while driving to work, he received a phone call that stopped his fast-paced life in its tracks. It was that day that Michael was given the diagnosis of CML. Throughout the interview, Michael so openly talks to me about the bouts of depression he came up against, and he tells me how he was able to overcome these hard times. This is an episode and a conversation, as Michael describes it to me, as his journey through a no man's land. Hi there, everyone. Welcome to Talking Blood Cancer. My name is Kate, and today we have Michael with us. So welcome, Michael.
Hi, Kate. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. As we always do every episode, we start off by asking the person we are interviewing, what is their name, where they're living in Australia, who is in their family, and when and what they were diagnosed with.
Okay, Michael Bowen is my name. I am living in Manly, Sydney. close thereabouts. I am married to Jordana, my wife, and I have two girls named Farah and Emerson. That's my immediate family. And I was diagnosed in February 2019 with chronic myeloid leukemia.
Wow. And what was like? What was happening in life before you were diagnosed in the lead up to it? What was going on for you?
Pretty normal life, to be honest, going through this, the normal stages of getting married and buying a house or trying to buy a house. And I don't know if anyone else lives in Sydney, but it's a sport down here. It's pretty hard to find somewhere. And then wanting to start family.
How old were you?
I was 32. My birthday's in September. So, yeah, 32 and a bit. Yeah, standard sort of life, good job, relatively healthy, good friends, good family and environment. Really looking forward to the future and the potential of what my life could bring. And the leading into it, I think Farah was, at the time I got diagnosed, Farah was 11 months old.
Okay.
And
that's your first, isn't it?
My first, yeah. She's now four and a bit. Terrible threes have rolled into frustrating
the three
fours.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Anyway, that's another story for another day. But yeah, for me, when I got married in 2016, my wife and I, we wanted to start a family, but it came pretty quickly. So we didn't have private health insurance to cover pregnancy. So when we found out, we were thinking, oh, all right, well, what are we going to do with private health? We got ourselves sorted and had Farah. But there's like a 12-month waiting period between certain things you can get, you know, chiropractic or optical and all that, dental and stuff. So for me, I was feeling healthy, didn't have too many issues, but my eyesight was starting to play up on me. I had these sort of black dots that would shoot across my eye, and or I'd wake up in the mornings and sort of wouldn't be able to see properly. But you know, after you have a shower and have a coffee, everything sort of comes good. So you didn't really think too much of it. So for me, there was no real major issues going on, but I do like a bit of a bargain. So I was waiting to go to the teach yourself optometrist to get a free pair of reading glasses.
So that's
what was the real driver for going to get my eyes checked, not because I thought I had anything else going on. So being the new health in health cover, they wanted to do a base case of my eyes. So they did all that and did all the standard checks, and the optometrist came back after sort of 5 minutes and longer than normal, and said that she said, oh, do you smoke? I said, no. She says, do you drink? I said, only on weekends. Do you lift heavy weights? I said, not as much as I used to or would like to. Being a new dad, you sort of don't get the chance to do all those things you used to do. And she said, oh, okay. She said, we just got a bit of an issue with your eyes. There seem to be a lot of blood clots and burst blood, arteries or sort of veins or whatever it is, but yeah, vessels behind your eyes. She printed out a picture of my eye and showed that essentially it's all bloodshot. So I was like, oh, okay. And I said, all right, so what does this mean? She goes, oh, look, you know, go see a specialist, have a look into it, but at the meantime, go to your GP and do a blood test. And me being me, I didn't even have a GP. You sort of go to a clinic, and if you've got a cold or you need to get a sick note, you just go and see whoever's on the desk. I didn't really have anyone. So I was like, okay, cool. Didn't think too much of it. A couple of days went past, and Jordana had to go to the doctors for something. And I was like, oh, that reminds me, I've got to go too. Can I join you and tag on to your appointment? And she goes, why? And then anyway, I showed her this picture of my eyes, and she goes, you're an idiot. What are you doing? You should have went when you got told. I said, I didn't think too much of it, darling. It's nothing. So don't worry about it. So anyway, we went the next day. That was on a Wednesday. And then Thursday morning. Wednesday I went to see the GP. She did her bit, and then I showed the GP my eyes and the results, and he shot up out of his chair really quick. He goes, "All right, come with me now. We'll go down the hall and get a blood test." Still nothing triggered. I was like, "All right, this guy's pretty diligent. I like this bloke. Maybe you should keep him in the loop. I come back to this guy." Anyway, did the blood test that afternoon. He sent him off the results, and then the next morning, I'm about to go to work, I got a call about 8:45, and he said, "Michael, I need you to go to North Shore or the closest local hospital." And I said, "Okay, why?" He said, "Oh, your blood results are back, and I'm a bit concerned about some of the results." I said, "And I'm not in health. I'm in financial wealth management. So for me, I didn't really trigger to anything." And he said, "Oh, no, you got to go. You got to go to hospital now." I said, "Oh, can I go this afternoon? I've got a pretty busy day." He goes, "No, now." And I was like, "Oh, okay, all right." I said, "So what am I turning up for?" I said, "I just don't want to turn up to emergency and, you know, just say that I've been told to come here and
my name's not around." Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to wait around, you know. And he said, "Your white blood cell count is quite elevated." And I said, "Okay, well, what's it normally?" And he said, "Oh, parts per million should be between 6 and 11, white blood cell count for a normal person." Mm-hmm. I said, "Okay, what am I?" And he goes, "140 or something."
Wow.
And I, okay.
And did you have any idea what that meant? Like, you were asking that question, but did you actually understand what any of that meant?
Look, we're all friends here, so I can admit that if someone asked me how to spell leukemia that morning, I would have struggled.
Yes, okay. So that was where your base knowledge was at.
So I had no idea. Like, I had nothing ever wrong with me. Playing sports through school, nothing ever was a problem. Didn't have a history in the family history of anything to do with this. So I said, "Okay, all right, 140, that's pretty high." Me being competitive, I said, "Is that the highest you've ever seen? And
if I'm going to do this well.
Yeah, I was like, where am I? Am I on the podium for this stuff or what? And he goes, no, Michael, seriously, you need to go. I said, "Well, what could happen?" He goes, "Well, you could have a stroke, you know, major organ failure, or it could be something else related to that." And I said, "Like what?" And he goes, "Oh, look, I don't know, but I'm just more worried about the possible stroke at the moment." I said, "Oh, shit."
He hadn't said the word leukemia or blood cancer or anything.
No leukemia, no cancer, no nothing. Yep. So my wife had the car that day, so I ordered an Uber to go to hospital. So still, I'm relaxed, you know. I got out of my suit and knew I'd be up there for a few hours. I probably wasn't going to work that day. So got changed, ordered an Uber. In the Uber, I called my wife. She works in medical devices, so she's in health and she understands this sort of stuff. And I said, "Oh, darling, my bloods have come in and it's a bit high." And I told her, and she goes, "Okay, all right, I'm leaving work now. I'm going to see you at Northern Beaches Hospital." So got in there, rocked up to emergency, and this is where it started to get a bit like, okay, this is not good. Rocked up to emergency. And went straight to the front of the line, and they opened up the doors for me, walked me straight in. No waiting, no sitting down, no nothing. They knew my name, they knew everything. And I was like, you don't want the red carpet service at an emergency hospital. So I started to think, "Oh shit, this is no good."
Yeah.
So they put me in one of the beds and pulled the curtain. My wife turned up. She was, in hindsight, pale as a ghost. So she knew something bad was happening, and I still was like, okay. So I had a few meetings I had to cancel, talk to my colleagues, cancel a few meetings, you know, give them a bit of background in work mode. Still wasn't still too. Yeah, I don't know if it's just defense mechanism. You sort of don't want to go and run off. Worrying has a low probability of success.
Mm-hmm.
So true. I try not to worry too much about these certain things. But I think that morning warranted some level of worrying, but anyway. So I took some more bloods, and within half an hour I come back in, open up the curtain and said, "Mr. Bowen, we need to talk to you." And I said, "Okay, yeah." So we both sat there, and they said, the nurse said, "We think you have leukemia."
Wow.
And I was like, "Really? it was February, so healthy, you know, summer, tan, you're in board shorts, you're feeling strong, healthy, no real issues, and someone just hits you with that news. So you're like, oh, okay, what does that mean? And they said, oh, look, we don't really know what type, how aggressive, what stage you're at. You're going to have to go to Rural North Shore, who have some more specialists and the like, and we want you to go now. And I was like, yeah, you look at my wife Jordana, and you just, yeah, burst out crying and in shock, and you know, it's just it's not a nice feeling. You wouldn't, yeah.
It's the moment in your life that stopped, that you just never envisioned.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's a marker, I guess, in your life, and that's a big line in the sand. And pre leukemia and post leukemia, that's the moment. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the noise of the curtain being pulled back and the pause of the lady. I'll never forget her face. You know, it's just very seared in your memory. And you start thinking instantly, sort of, Farah, my oldest, she was 11 months at the time. The potential for your life, you feel shocked. Obviously, my wife and I had only been married a couple of years, so what's our life going to look like? And then the guilt that starts to come with that as well. All these other emotions start coming through your mind, and you sort of get through that initial shock, and then you've got to go across town. So it's probably about a 40-minute ride or so. We're going to get an ambulance, but they're going to be another hour or so. So they said, look, it's best to, you haven't got a broken arm or anything, so it's probably best just to drive yourself. And so yeah, that drive across town was sort of felt like you're just floating.
Yeah, it would have been so surreal.
Yeah, you sort of sometimes watch movies and you hear these stories and things like that, but when it's happened to you at the time, you're sort of it's an out-of-body experience, and you sort of can see yourself thinking.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was the drive, and then we got there, and I've listened to a couple of other
podcasts. What do you talk about? Like in that drive, as you said, you had 40 minutes in Sydney traffic, potentially could have been longer. Like do you sit there in silence? Do you just... As you said, you're in shock. Like,
yeah, I think my wife and I are pretty practical sort of people. We're both the eldest, so we've been grown up that you've got to have responsibilities, and you got to stand up when you can, when you need to. And there's a couple. I can't remember specifics to the conversation, but you know, it's just what do we do next, and some practical things, but. You can't not having any experience with this and not knowing the questions asked, how did it happen? Why did it happen? Why now? Could I have prevented it? But you didn't have any of these questions because you literally were going to see the specialist. So there's a lot more, and you didn't even know what type it was. I refused to look into things and run down rabbit holes. I just knew that it wasn't going to be helpful. So we got to North Shore, and we oncology, and went up there, and level four it is, and you walk in, and it's a sterile, grey environment. There's no kids there, because when you think of leukemia, you might think of kids, children having it primarily. But yeah, there's no kids there, but you see, there's a lot of sickness and people right at the end of their tenure, and. There's no laughter. There's no happiness. It's just grey and sterile and quiet.
It's a place, if you've never been in it, you couldn't even imagine it, could you? The emotion in those rooms as well.
Yeah, exactly. And as I said, it was the end of February, so looking healthy, feeling healthy, fit, in board shorts and a shirt, t-shirt. Got a tan, like it's just totally
not where you think
different environment. I was like, oh, that's like, what the hell am I doing here? How'd I end up here? So then you take your bed, you take your room, they come in, do some more tests, and some of the junior doctors come in, and next thing you know, a couple of hours later, Chris Arthur, one of the leading doctors, for leukemia in Sydney. He rolls in and introduces himself, and he says, "All right, Michael, we think you've got chronic myeloid leukemia."
Mm-hmm.
I see the case. What does that mean? He goes on about sort of chronic and acute and different stages, and he says, "But we think it's the best type of leukemia you can get." And I looked at him and said, "Fuck off."
Yeah. Really?
I was like, I don't want any cancer, mate.
Yeah.
Not the best type, the worst type, none of this stuff. So how do I get rid of it, or what's happened? So he said, "Look, we don't really know. We're going to have to do a bone marrow, is it biopsy?"
Yep, biopsy, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So they don't tickle too no, much.
They do not. Did they give you any funny gas? Did they give you anything to?
No, they gave me a general, but to be honest, I was screaming like a 16-year-old at a Justin Bieber concert. I wasn't. Yeah. I wasn't.
You weren't.
I wasn't. Oh no! I nearly broke my wife's hand, I think, when it happened. But so you sit there, and then you're like, "All right, so cool. I've been told what it is. I've got a label that I can now look into," and they give you all these pamphlets, and they give you all this information, and talk about sort of treatment options, and he is right. On reflection, sort of chronic myeloid leukemia, and the drugs that I take, Tasigna, nilotinib, it's got a couple of different names, but
yeah.
I'm on 600 milligrams of that a day, two tablets in the morning and two at night. That's all I really need to do. I didn't have to go through too much more than the biopsy, and yeah, so pretty lucky. But when he's telling you that, the hardest thing is then you've got to call your mum and dad and your brothers and sisters, and then you've got to run through all your mates and tell them and work, yeah, all that sort of stuff. So just the overwhelming sense of the potential for our life and not possibly seeing my eldest grow up, yeah, it's very daunting and a very heavy situation to be in.
I think, as you said, like, even though they go, "Oh, it's the good one," or whatnot, no cancer is good, right? It doesn't. They all have their pros and their cons, and it's you don't get out of it scot free, and your life at that moment is changed forever. As you said, it's a very thick line drawn in the sand. Is that it's, unfortunately, it can't quite be what it was before a diagnosis.
Yeah, and even with chronic myeloid leukemia, what I have, there's various different responses, and different people have different reactions. Some are really lethargic, and some of the drugs don't work. The first, second, the third generation drugs don't work. I think I'm on the third generation. So physically, I don't know, about 6 months afterwards, a lot of my body hair started to drop off, much to my wife's pleasure. She didn't mind a bit of that. But eyebrows started to thin out, but the hair on my head, most people listening won't see this, but I've got a pretty thick set of hair. So that fortunately stayed. So there's different changes that happen, and they have different effects on you physically, but also emotionally, mentally, and then how you see yourself in the mirror and how you think other people see you and your level of confidence, and then all these other things, anxiety and everything else that comes with it. There's so many things that you just, under the physical side of things, under the surface, that's where 80% of the battle is, to be honest.
Because that's what I was going to ask. You know, we talk about a lot, and there's a lot of conversation and that can be point towards a woman when they are diagnosed, they lose their hair. Sometimes they will have long hair and their appearance has changed and things like that. How did that affect you and your confidence and the way you presented to society?
Well, first of all, I had two voices in my head. One was just hide away in the corner. Don't share too much. Don't say too much. Don't be vulnerable, or don't come across as sort of anything less than who you were. My internal thoughts were, what is this? It's in my bone marrow. It's in my genetic makeup. Like, is this, where else is this going to go? And what else can it do to me? And what can the drugs do to me? And so for me, I was diagnosed in 21st of Feb, and I was in quite shocked that my little brother, he was doing some stuff for the World's Greatest Shave, or he donated to one of his friends doing it. And I'd heard of the World's Greatest Shave, but I never really participated in it or donated to it. I donated to different things through time, but not that one. And for me, I was like, sweet, I'm going to do this. I'm going to shave my head, raise some money. And in retrospect, I think it was a defense mechanism because I could isolate myself. I could raise money for others who yes. have leukemia mm-hmm. or are affected by it. And sort of separate myself and put myself at arm's length so I could then deal with it and let it come back into me when I wanted it to, because yeah. I had no control over being Wednesday I was healthy, Thursday I wasn't.
Yes.
Come pretty fast.
Yes.
So for me, I started to put a lot of time and effort into that. And one
it
of the
feels like give you something practical to do as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So something to, you know, have structure towards, something to chip away at. You know, you got a number, you want to raise 2,500 and then you raise, or you hit that target and you increase it. So for me, I think with that, there's a selfish part, which is try and push this thing away and deflect and try and raise awareness and money for others. But also equally being so close to a specialist, you learn that a lot of families don't have that short distance, and you see that there were some people in the hospital that had family that in, I don't know, Mudgee or Orange or
yeah,
and you read others up in sort of central Queensland or Western Victoria, for example, that have to travel sort of 6 hours or more to be at hospital, and their families can't be there. I was just thinking myself, like, if Jordana and my little one weren't so close, like, she wouldn't be able to be there that day. She'd have to dial in and do FaceTime, for example. And so for me, I realized that I was told that if you raise a certain amount of money, I think it's $500 a week, you could provide accommodation for a family of four or three to be close by. So I was like, all right, sweet, let's try and get five families covered, so $500, so $2,500. So that was my goal. But at the same time, I knew that if I was going to try and be successful, I had to be open and vulnerable and talk about it and what it means. Because mm-hmm. if you don't talk about what you're going through, I found that most people don't know what to say to you, yeah. and they get awkward, not because mm-hmm. they are awkward, but they just don't know what to say and how to answer you. But if you have confidence in what you're talking about, or confidence in actually talking about something like that's quite life-threatening, and sharing the vulnerabilities, most people, you know, I found sort of 9 out of 10 will come with open arms and want to help and try and do things. So that 2,500,
the leader, sorry. Don't you, sorry, you almost have to be the leader and help direct people is how you're willing to be open or allow people to go, no, it's okay to ask, hey, how are you going today? Or what's happening for you? Or because I'm
yeah, exactly.
Well, they really take their guidance from the patient or the carer.
Yeah. And just the sort of mental health awareness that was starting sort of when 15, 16, you'd have It's Not Weak to Speak and all these different charities talking about mental health, that sort of helped. It's a generational thing, but in my generation, sort of mid-30s, there's a lot more chatter and openness and resources around mental health. So I thought if you can tag in with that to what people are going through, it just makes you a better network, a better community, a better society to help those that are vulnerable and in need. So that's one of the drivers. So for me, that 2,500 was surpassed in 24 hours.
Wow. Incredible.
Which is pretty nice.
Absolutely.
So then I doubled it to 5. And that was done with another 24 hours. And then we doubled it to 10. And
wow, that impact is incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty good outshowing. I worked for a global business at the time, so I had people all around the world that were working with me donating and
yeah.
And family and friends around, I'm originally from Newcastle, but yeah, got family and friends all over the place and they were helping out and raising awareness. So when we got to about 20, I said, all right, this is awesome. And then Will, who was, you're not there now, but Will was working for the Leukemia Foundation, and he calls me. He goes, Mike, you raised quite a bit of money. Do you know there's a leaderboard? And I was like, this bastard knows that I'm competitive. So remembering I asked the doctor at the time, 140, is that, am I on the podium for that? So I'm pretty competitive. And I was like, hang on a second, there's a individual and a team ranking. And I said, all right, well, where am I at? I think I was at 13th or something, 20K. And I was like, all right, here we go. So I ended up raising just over 34. I came third nationally for that year, and the only two that beat me was a Brisbane radio station and the ABC National News.
Wow.
So if I had a radio station or a TV channel, but I was pretty happy with that, naturally being able to help people, and yeah, many families were helped, and being a part of the fabric of the Leukemia Foundation and the World's Greatest Shave that year was great. But the lights go off and the show finishes and they move on to the next event, and you've left there with a buzz cut, and everyone goes home and you're thinking, now what?
Yep. And
so the next anxiety, depression, anger.
Yeah.
That would have been sort of March, April. Would have been what? Yeah, for the next 4 or 5 months, I've never really suffered from those types of conditions in the past, but to a point where you'd wake up in the morning and your hands would be shaking all day, all night, not being able to communicate properly or speak or finish your sentences. It's just not a nice. I did. And you don't know if it's the drugs or you don't know if it's, you don't, you just.
So much is out of your control.
Yeah. And my tolerance, I was listening to his podcast. He spoke about he got a bit short, and his tolerance for people's thing, other, their experiences or things that they think are important, it was not there. Mine was really short. I did not give two hoots.
Yeah.
I was angry. I had no answers to what caused it. Some days you're sitting there going, why me? And what's this all about? And what else is going to come next? And you just get into this vortex or a spiral of just negative thoughts and negative energy that just compounds on itself. And next thing you know, your brain's, you've got 4 or 5 conversations going on at once, and it's just not healthy. Yeah. Which has effects on your immediate relationships with your wife and your friends and your family and all these other things. So,
and your child too. You were in the peak, as you said, like you were in the peak of living and growing that beautiful family environment and having, you know, your beautiful wife, your beautiful daughter, and looking forward to life being full throttle, and then it stopped you in your tracks.
Yeah. So, after a couple of months, you know, you're not yourself, and my wife said, I need to get some help and go see a psychologist, and I'd never done that before. And
were you to be honest, I didn't.
I was, because I like behavioral stuff. I like understanding what makes people tick, and had an interest in it. So I was interested to understand what these psychologists did and how they worked. And I didn't want to take I got offered to go speak to someone about it, or I could take some more drugs to help with that, or both. And I said, well, I'm already taking enough drugs. I don't want to take any more. So I'll go and have a chat with somebody. And to be honest, it wasn't the best experience. So my advice would be, if you were seeking some advice or talking to people about it, and it's not working, don't persist with it. I persisted for 13, 14 sessions, and I didn't get much out of it, probably didn't help with my mindset and maybe prolonged my.
I always say it's like blind dating. You don't know who you're going to get. It's really hard to know who to match up and if you're going to work. And as you beautifully said, if it's not working, don't be deterred to find someone else. Do seek someone else as well.
And I had a pretty good experience. I spoke to a couple of the counselors the Leukemia Foundation in our time, and the council was great, and you know it felt good, and they were empathetic. And then you go see more of a clinical psychologist, and again, it just didn't work out. So first time it didn't work out. I went and saw someone else after that in a different capacity, and it did. But I think yeah, that experience, just trying to get on the same wavelength and someone that's sort of your age and understands where you're coming from and the stage of life you're going through, probably is useful if you do go that way. But I reckon I was, I would have been 4 or 5 months from peak to trough, back to peak again about coming through, and it just got to a point where I couldn't keep going on like that. I had to step out of that mindset. Yeah, I worked. So when I got diagnosed, I think I had 3 days off.
Wow.
I didn't, not because I'm some trying to be anything that I'm not, but mm-hmm. I just wanted to keep the consistency of the day and the structure. Mm-hmm. I could have replaced that with probably some more exercise. That's probably one thing I should have done, a bit more physical exertion exercise to just dust out all the mental thoughts as opposed to sitting around thinking about things. But yeah, so I try to keep some structure. But yeah, I worked pretty much the whole way through, and then you come out the other side. We bought a house, and I think that helped.
We had some positivity.
Some another line in the sand. So another, get married, buy a house, have kids, all those major milestones. This one was a positive one. It was in my control and my choice. So we got our choice. Yeah. Because that's got started, and then you have the ability to then focus on that. But it wasn't fun for that period. But it's just a matter of, it's sort of like you can't physically force yourself to go and do something, but mentally you have to say to yourself, all right, today I have to focus on a positive. I have to focus on a major win or work towards a major goal and two minor goals.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And if the magic goal was mowing the lawn,
yeah,
so be it. That was your goal. Yep. If your minor goal was to
shower,
or go outside for a walk in the sunshine, or go and pick up your little one from daycare and just sit and watch them for 15 minutes before they actually have to finish and come home, like just little things like that, just trying to get some sort of control back and structure back to your thoughts and your mindset.
Yeah, because I think you're so right. Like, it's people think as goals as these big, huge things that they need to achieve, whether it's, especially after they get diagnosed, say, for instance, exercise or managing their fatigue. Like, oh, I could used to run a kilometre. Why can't I do that now? But it's like, just break it down a bit more, and it's almost that acceptance of going, okay, well, today if I just walk to the letterbox, that's a big goal for me, because 2 months ago I couldn't even get out of bed post-treatment or transplant.
Yeah. So I just try to – I'm quite a visual learner and sort of thinker, so I just try to think about, all right, brick by brick, how am I going to build the foundations of this pillar, and what's this pillar mean, and what is it going to build for the next foundation, and then what am I working towards, and what do I what do I want to do with my life, and where do I want to be, and – and just other things like being kinder to yourself, and realizing that when you do, if you're kinder to yourself, you communicate better with yourself. And if you're better communicated with yourself, you're better communicated to your immediate partner and your loved ones, and then you're better communicated with your friends and extended network and everything else that comes with that. So I think trying to focus on being a better communicator within my own head was a major goal that I worked on. And it's always going. I don't have 6 or 7 voices in my head now. I only have 2 or 3, so I'm halfway home. Everyone has different things going on, but then other things like trying to come off the drugs. So we just had Farah naturally. That's the other thing, going through IVF, and for men it's a bit easier. You go to the clinic and
donate your sperm and off you go.
Yeah, you pick up your vial and you're in and out with your partner. They have to go through injections and treatments and all these other things that you're sort of sitting there thinking, if I didn't get this chemo, this couldn't be happening. So that's a, that, that also starts to get into your mind and other things. Yeah, it's just complex. But yeah, so we're going through that. So we had Emerson, my second daughter. She was born. We were successful with IVF in May 2020. Mm-hmm. So keep in mind, like we got diagnosed in February 19. You go through sort of 6 to 9 months of shit. You're about to start 2020, new year, new me, let's do this, let's go. And then bought a house. The settlement was late January. Mm-hmm. And then COVID hits.
Wow.
And you think, all right, well, first of all, there goes the value of my home's just halved. So great. And second of all, I've now got this global pandemic that could affect my health and I'm compromised at some point. So it's just shit show. So we're like, all right, how are we going to be?
You're still on treatment, yeah? Like you were?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, taking the tablets every morning, every night, and still trying to work towards that major molecular goal of 0.000.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there. I got there after 11, 12 months. So I was there, and then they want to hold you there for at least 2 years. So I had a 3-year sort of goal. So that was still ticking away in the background. So we had tried IVF in May 2020, successful. Farah was born.
Did you have to get off treatment?
No, because when I was talking to Dr. Chris Arthur in February 19, I said, all right, well, we're sort of only just started our family. What are the effects of the drugs on fertility? And he said, oh, look, there's some strong evidence that there's no effect, but he said, you can't ever say 100%. So if you are worried about it and considering, you can always go to the IVF clinic and do your thing, banks and sperm, yeah. And so before I started the nilotinib treatment, I was actually, for the first week, they put me on these chemo tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And it all have different effects on people, but my testes, they were like really, really sore. That was the only thing that really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell the doctors and they go, oh, that's interesting. I've never heard of that before. And I'm like, well, look at the long list of side effects of all this stuff. And that's one of the side effects.
Yeah.
You're telling me I'm special with this too. So that was a couple of first week that I had that. And with that in mind, I was like, who knows what these drugs are doing to your body and your major organs and their long-term effects. So I was like, all right, we're going to get it clinic. So I did that for the first couple of weeks before I started my treatment. So nothing was – men are on a – some people may know this, but men are on a 72-day cycle. So if you want to go on treatment or even coming off treatment, which I'll talk in a sec, you've got 72 days. So we had a bit of time to put some boys in the bank, as I tell my mates. And then we use those. Yes, I know. I love my girls.
Women.
Yeah, yeah. If I have 10 kids, I'll have 10 girls, I think.
Yeah.
So we did that. And then, so yeah, so Emerson, she was an IVF baby, which was great. She was born in January 21. And I was like, all right, cool. Got a 3-year time horizon. Numbers are really low. I would prefer to come off the drugs before the girls really started to know what I was doing. So my oldest is 4 and a bit now. So, she, you know, my first memories are sort of 5, 6
mm-hmm.
years of age. So I was trying to get off them and it'll be a conversation for a day when they're more emotionally understanding and stable, I guess. So I wanted to get off those. So we came off after 3 years, which was February 22. And numbers were low for the first couple of months, doing the results, everything's all good. And then I had a couple of missed calls in quick succession from a no number. And knowing how many doctors call me from no numbers, I was like, oh, here we go. This is not good.
Yeah.
So I answered the next time they called and I said, oh, Michael, just want to let you know your numbers have started to increase. You're sort of sitting at 0.001 for a few months, which was great, but now you're at sort of 0.008.
Hmm.
It's starting to come back. And I was like, oh, well, I was at 140, remember, last time, Doc, so I've got a long
way to go here.
Let's, and we want to try for a third. So he goes, yeah. A couple of months later, numbers are backwards, up, back and up over 0.1, which means I'm back on the drug. So that that experiment didn't work this time around. It was always a probability. Yeah, not fun. Because of the mental dip that I went through and period of time, I didn't know if going back on the drugs would have a same effect. Didn't know how quickly I'd get the numbers back down, which I'm still trying to wait for those results to come in to see where they're currently sitting at. But yeah, it was always it wasn't a possibility it would come back. It was a probability. I knew that. But yeah. I thought if I could come off for a good at least 72 days to 6 months, I could avoid the IVF treatment for my wife and all those other things. So yeah, it's just so many different emotions that go through. But again, it's just a hurdle that you need to work through.
How long do you wait between blood tests? Like, do you get when you're on medication
monthly?
And what's that weight loss? Because I know that a lot of people with chronic leukemia, that's kind of really sometimes their only baseline or their checkpoint, yeah. Where an acute person gets almost weekly, if not daily, in some instances.
Yeah.
Do you go, okay, well, I got that checkpoint this month, then you breathe for the first 2 weeks and a half, and then as you kind of get closer to that 4 week or that whenever you get that blood test, does your anxiety peak? Did your mind start running away, or do you experience that?
Yeah, I mentioned before, worrying has a low probability of success, so I try not to worry about things that are outside of my control. I think that's probably one thing I've gotten a lot better at, is understanding what you can and can't control, and even if you can control things, is it really that important? So for me, knowing that I had a pretty good response the first time around, like I was doing monthlies the first sort of 6 months of being diagnosed was monthlies, then it went to 3 months, then it went to 6 months. So I was in that sort of cycle, and then coming back on them, it's just monthly until I get back down to 0.000. So I have every confidence that it's working. I don't have any missed numbers from no caller ID as much as what I was.
Yeah.
So that's a good signal to me. And is, as I spoke about before, just a major goal and two minors. And the minor goal for me at the moment is not getting a missed call from an unknown number a week after my blood results. So I'll just keep sticking to that.
Ultra. Like I hear what you said, and I think it's so valuable. But I'm thinking, as someone listening who's in those moments going, but how does he do that? Like, how do you not worry? And is it a mantra that you just constantly say to yourself? And was it something that you did at the beginning, but you've had to get better at? Or
yeah, you have different people. When you share your story, you have different people with different experiences, and some people are very blunt, and other people are very sympathetic, and everyone's got their opinion on what you should do or what they would do. But a few people have sort of said to me at the tough medicine end, you know, we're all going to die of something. At least you know what yours is. And I'm like, well, lucky I live in a world where medicine, the age of where it is. Like, if I got diagnosed in say 2015, my treatment path would have been quite different. So I'm very, very lucky to have that. But I think another point is sort of compartmentalizing things and giving. It's okay to have a cry every now and again, or get frustrated, or you're angry and you just want to do a boxing class, or or run until you vomit, just to take that energy and to put it into something else. But I think the ability to compartmentalize things and just, it's there, it's at the back of your mind, it's in a little shoebox that just sits in the shelf, on the bottom shelf, and it's always going to be there, and if and when it needs to come out, where it is and why it's come out. So it takes time to get to that point. Talking to psychologists, talking to people, trying different things. Like, I've tried heaps of different Western and Eastern medicine, herbs and potions, and standing on one foot for 10 minutes in the morning, just random stuff just to see what works and what doesn't work. And I think most of it didn't really work, but you learn from those sort of things. And
is that for your mental health or for the chronic?
It's all a bit of both, to be honest. The chronic, I'm never going to get an answer as to why it turned up. It's the first thing I asked was, well, can I pass this on to Farah, or did I, or could I pass it on? So that's a no. Like, you don't get it from your parents, you don't get it from anyone else. So I've always told everyone I'm special, but I'm really special because I've got some genetic mutation that caused this, but we don't know why or what caused it. And it's interesting because they said, oh, exposure to nuclear could have been a reason for it, or stress, severe stress. And I was like, okay, well, I just got married and had a baby, not enough, that's it. But it's funny because we had planned to go to Japan for a holiday in mid-18, and we were going in April 19, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of months after I was diagnosed. So imagine if we went to Japan, and obviously nuclear reactors and things in Japan and energy they use over there, went over there, come back, my eyes were a bit fuzzy, went and got blood tested, then got results, and then bang, I would have had that as the reason. All right, I went to Japan, I got it, and I would have hated Japan, would have said everyone, Japan's this, Japan's that.
Yeah.
Because I was looking for something to cause or blame or whatever it may be, an answer. But I got diagnosed 2 to 3 months before I went. Mm-hmm. So it's just funny, having that reflection or the ability to think through things or around things is that we're always going to be trying to find and understand what caused things or have an answer to stuff or try and control things. But at the end of the day, it's, I guess, how you sort of how you respond to those thoughts or how you respond. And the control around wanting to know answers is now a control around how I control my emotions and my mindset and sort of who I want to be around and where my energy goes and what my goals are and what I want to do and why I want to do them. Like living overseas for a period of time, I don't know, would be great. Our honeymoon was in Sri Lanka. So when the girls are older, when they're old enough to enjoy it, we'll that's a goal to take them back there. Yeah. Saving towards doing a renovation or knockdown of the house. Just all these other things is where I want to put my positive thoughts to and energy towards and just letting control. The rest of it. Yeah, well, control your emotions around it, what those drivers are. So sort of this passive, what motivates you and what keeps you going and what gets you out of bed and why you do certain things through the day is just understanding where your energy is going to and why and realizing also some days you just don't want to do anything. Some days you just feel terrible. And
it's okay.
And it's okay. The world's still going to do exactly what it was going to do and people are going to do what they were going to do anyway. It's just that some days you don't have to participate. So every now and again, I'll do that. And really just, try and enjoy the people you're with and the energy you put into those relationships and try not to sweat the small stuff, be kinder to yourself, communicate better with yourself. And I think if you can do that, you become a more well-rounded individual and you become a better husband and father and a friend. And you just can, it's for me, everyone has different reasons, but for me, those are some of the things that I'm trying to value at the moment. I don't need to drive a fancy car.
It hasn't been a bed of roses for you to get to this point, and it's still not a bed of roses either. It's it hasn't been easy for you to hit these points and to get to this mindset either. So
So the next steps for me is getting my numbers back to where they need to be and giving back to the Leukemia Foundation as much as I can. So it's not always, I realize it's not always just putting money down on the table and shaving your head. It can go towards doing these types of podcasts or turning up to events or just talking with people that are going through it somewhere else. Like my uncle, when I was diagnosed, my uncle's brother, so my uncle by marriage, his brother was diagnosed with CML about 2 months after I was.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he said to me, he said, the reason why I was so compassionate towards him, because they're all, you know, generations, you don't talk too much of it. Everything's sort of superficial and sarcastic, you know, go fishing and camping and doing those sort of things. But you don't really sit down and talk at much depth about these sort of things. But he said to me, after talking with you and you sharing your story and what it means and how vulnerable you were and how you, where your mindset was, he said, when he was diagnosed, I was just on like level three already and how I could communicate with him and show how I could help. And their relationship was gone from strength to strength on that just by me being open and vulnerable and sharing it and talking about things. So those are things that you can't put a dollar value on, but if you can help one person, which for me was great, it was an immediate family member, but these type of podcasts and speaking at events or going on TV, all those sort of things, if they can reach one or two people that
make them feel safe.
I think that's the thing. People, when you go through this, you naturally want to, you know, want to feel safe.
And, absolutely. It's a natural instinct, right? We as humans, we don't run towards pain. We run away from it. We want to be safe. And I think that is why this podcast was developed, because the amount of times I've sat in front of people that have said, I just want to hear someone else's story. I want to talk to someone else. But also having heard people say, I've been up in hospital by myself or at home at 3 a.m. in the morning, freaking out. So if we have this platform for people to be able to press play here and go, it's a really dark day, but you're going to be okay. You're going to get through these hours, and these are some people that have. So
Yeah, for me, it just reminded me talking about that when I was sitting in hospital and trying to read things, and I've said this on other podcasts, I felt like I was in no man's land.
Yeah.
Where I was old enough to look after myself. I was 32. I had a good job, had a feeding a family, starting a family. So I didn't need mum and dad. I wasn't as if I was, you know, 6 or 16 or whatever it may be, where you're still at home. But I also wasn't 80, like most of the other people in the oncology ward that were sitting there that had lived their lives, they've reached their potential, they've gone and ticked off their bucket lists and their family, They watched their family grow up and all these other things. So I was sitting in the middle. That's what started to piss me off. I was like, this is so unfair, where I'm in this zone where I'm old enough to look after myself, but also not at a point where I've achieved things or experienced things and reached their potential. So I felt like this sort of no man's land. And when I started to talk about that to the counselors at Leukemia Foundation, they obviously, wanted me to reach out and connect with other males, you know, 25 to 40-ish around the country and sort of talk through the same thing. And that was something that really helped me through those dark periods, being able to communicate with them. And I found myself giving them sort of my opinion and my advice and telling them what they should do. And then reflecting on it, going, why aren't you doing this yourself, Michael? Why are you talking to people? Then you go back and you go upstairs and then you sit and watch TV and none of this stuff you just said is being taken in. So I feel like a bit of a fraudster at some point. So I was like, all right, you got to change this, mate. You got to start listening to the stuff you're helping other people do to start helping yourself. Exactly. So yeah. So that was helpful. So these type of platforms and the foundation and the ability to connect people that that are in that no man's land, I think, is quite helpful. And I've heard women as well that are going through sort of childbearing years or just trying to start a family, having to go through treatment, they're connected with other women that are going through that too. So I think, the ability to have these types of mediums where people can read, listen or watch is great and connect. And I'm sure a few people connected with me on I'm not too big on the socials, the money on the socials, if I'm trying to raise money, to be honest, for the Leukemia Foundation. But people reached out on Instagram or Facebook at some points and just wanted to have a chat about things. So I think that's a great outcome to a difficult diagnosis and time, but there's always silver linings to things that you can focus on and therefore spend your energy on.
Yeah. Well, I'm very conscious of the time and we are coming up to that hour mark, and we do usually ask people to wrap up, you know, if there was any golden nuggets they would like to share, but you have beautifully done that, I think, in the last 10 minutes as well. But is there anything that we've missed, or is there anything that you would share, or wisdom or pearls that you would offer somebody?
I think, yeah, just communicating. Communication is key. Be kind to yourself and communicate better with yourself, and just be accountable for where you want to spend your thoughts and your time and your energy. And yep. It might take you a week to get your hands around that. It might take you a month. It might take you a year. But as long as you're still working towards that and getting better each day, I think those are some of the things that people can look forward to. Mm-hmm. The power, the feeling of giving back and doing something for someone else is five times better than someone doing it for you. So I think that's something that's really got me through, and I'll continue to do no matter what my diagnosis is. If I'm on the drugs, or I'm off the drugs, or I'm in remission, whatever it may be, I'm a Leukemia Foundation member forever. And it's a nice community to be in.
Yeah. Well, as Oprah Winfrey does always say, you know, to help others is sometimes the biggest way that you can help yourself and to get yourself out of that. So, look, I wish you all the very best. I hope that you nail every goal that you've set for yourself, for your health, for your children, for your future, and for your wife as well. So thank you so much for sharing your story today, and I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, Kate. Thanks to everyone for listening. And until next time, thanks very much.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode. We hope that you found it helpful in some way. If you would like more information on today's show or our services, please feel free to contact 1-800-620-420, and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. Also, if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe, share, or even give us a rating on your podcast app. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Kate Arkadiff, and you've been listening to the Leukemia Foundation's podcast, Talking Blood Cancer.